the time to show them leaders what is on your mind. It is time that they come up with a plan how to unite the whole Caribbean. Year after year, it's the same old thing. They keep it meeting after meeting. Tell them we want unity and we want it right away. San humanity.
Well, you know, I've just got to say that it is it was sort of prescient, you know, that last cut that we listened to there. It was recorded something like 15 years before Barack Obama came to the presidency. But I swear at the end of that song they were singing his name. Don't you think? Barack Obama, Barack Obama. Okay. That's right. It's the announcement music. It is time for Sperio Anuncios, announcements for you.
So our first announcement is that on this coming Saturday, on September 12th, at 4 p.m., there's going to be a talk about farmer suicides that have been happening in Vidarbha, India. The talk is by the researcher Jaideep Hardikar, who's a National Media Fellow and a KK Birla Foundation Fellow, who's done a lot of research on Vidarbha and the plight of the people displaced due to a development project there. So it's going to be at 4 p.m. in MIT room 4231. And the interesting thing I'm reading on this is that apparently close to 200,000 farmers have killed themselves in India since 1997. Over 40,000 of them in Maharashtra state of India alone, and a majority of them in Vidarbha. And once known as a breadbasket, the Warhad region is really grim statistics. So.
Just looking at the time, it is almost 7 o'clock here at WMBR Cambridge, and so we're going to try and wrap it up as fast as we can for you. But we had so many wonderful announcements that we wanted to tell you about. So real quick, tomorrow night at 8 p.m., the MIT Salsa Rueda group, Salsa Casino Rueda, is going to be doing a party at the YWCA in Central Square. That's at 7 Temple Street in Central Square, Cambridge. That's for those of you who like to do salsa casino or would like to learn what that is. It's a Cuban style of salsa. It's quite impressive. And obviously, all Sunday, as we've been talking about all day today, we have, of course, the Caribbean Carnival here in Cambridge, and if you are interested in checking that all out, it begins at 12 noon, and activities go on and on and on after that.
So that wraps it up for today. Again, you've been listening to Sperio on WMBR Cambridge. We hope you enjoyed the show.
Oh, and next week, we will be talking about environmental racism, transit racism, and other fascinating topics related to the environment and transit here in the Boston area. We're going to be talking to people from ACE, the Alternative Community Environment Organization. Oh my goodness, I can't get their name right. And also TRUE, the Tea Riders Union. And they will be coming to talk with us about some of the stuff that's going on in the area. It's 7:02, time for us to be quiet. Stay tuned for Music for Human Beings, Alternatives for Community Environment. I knew I would get it eventually. All right. Gracias, gracias a todos. Hasta la vista.
I am a Dr. Jalis Sakran, and I welcome you. Welcome to Music for Human. Music for Human is New Age Talk Radio with an emphasis on you here on WMBR 88.1 FM. I have with me today Dr. Zina, Frau Dr. Zina Pfannkuchen.
Guten Abend.
Guten Abend.
It's lovely to be here.
Dr. Pfannkuchen is an expert on Marxian Marxism.
Indeed. I specialize in particularly neological forms of Marxism, that is the fabrication and manufacture of new words.
Which I suppose is also a capitalist enterprise.
It engages relations of production, and we are living in the end stages of a capitalist economy, so therefore, we are not living outside of capitalism, though we are resisting and attempting to create autonomous spaces within a capitalist economy.
Welcome, Doctor. We also have with us Professor Levine, who's a mystic Jewish professor. Professor, welcome.
It's great to be here again.
It is so great to have you with us. So, and before we even start, I'd like to remind everyone that it is now Ramadan, which means that I, along with the faithful, are fasting. And breakfast has just passed, the moment of breakfast, so we would like to indicate this with the following song while we eat and drink for the first time since dawn this morning.
Fruit salad, yummy, yummy. Fruit salad, yummy, yummy. Fruit salad, yummy, yummy.
Yummy, 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 yummy. Fruit salad.
Let's make some fruit salad today.
Oh, oh, oh.
It's fun to do, it's a healthy way.
Oh, oh, oh.
Take all the fruit that you want to eat. It's going to be a fruit salad treat.
The first step,
peel your bananas.
The second step,
toss in some grapes.
The third step,
chop up some apples. Chop up some melons and put them on your plate. Now we've made it, it's time to eat it.
Oh,
it tastes so good that you just can't beat it.
Oh,
give everyone a plate and a spoon. We'll all be eating it very soon.
The first step,
eat up the banana.
The second step,
eat up some grapes.
The third step,
eat up some apples. Eat the melons, now there's nothing on your plate. Now we've had our fruit salad today.
Oh,
it's time to put the scraps away.
Oh,
wash the bowls and wash the spoon. Let's do it all again real soon.
Fruit salad, yummy, yummy. Fruit salad, yummy, yummy. Fruit salad, yummy, yummy.
Yummy, 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 yummy. Fruit salad.
Fruit salad, yummy, yummy. 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 Salad, yummy, yummy. Fruit salad.
Oh, that's so wonderful, the idea there of fruit salad.
I think that it represents a metaphor for the kind of world that we might be living in. That is to say, a world in which there are many fruits and vegetables interacting amongst each other. This can be a kind of a goal for a more diverse, harmonious society, don't you think?
Well, Frau Doctor, I actually agree that often acting metaphorically can have some strange symbolic effect on the real world. So I actually thought that perhaps as an advocate of the downfall of capitalism, as a symbolic act, you might first advocate removing capitalization from our spelling conventions.
Yes, so there's a theorist named Bell Hooks, who is a black feminist writer, a very famous, well-known writer on the left in this country. She spells her name Bell Hooks with no capitalization, precisely to enact that same metaphor. And a variety of other writers, black feminists, other strains of feminists, have also taken on a similar style of spelling. In German, as you know, we capitalize many more letters, and with the advent of text messaging and chatting, there's been a similar push to get rid of capital letters because it is one additional keystroke. And so here you see both on the left and with the advent of new capitalist technologies and consumerism running rampant, there's also these parallel strains to reduce capital letters. So I think, as you see, this is a dialectical process. As we remove capital letters, what our movement has been done, what has attempted to use as an activist tactic, has been taken up by the structures of capitalism. They
it's
have co-opted
actually,
the same technique.
A paradoxical action, too, because capitalism and our consumer society has led to text messaging, which has led to the downfall of capitalization, which will symbolically lead to the downfall of capitalism itself. So it's almost as if capitalism is eating itself. It's like the snake eating its own tail.
Yes, or indeed the classic Marxist metaphor that a system contains within the seed of its own destruction. Or perhaps a small text message could be the seed.
Or the fly who has the poison on one wing and the cure for the poison, the antidote, on the other wing.
Yes, the pharmacon. It can kill you or cure you. You're never quite sure.
Now, on a somewhat related topic of symbolism and the real world, today, of course, in the Boston area, the weather was quite gloomy for the first time in many months. And this sort of, to me, is at least a reminder of the mortality of our existence and the ultimate shallowness and emptiness of life on Earth. And I think it's important to be reminded of that. And those unfortunate souls who live in tropical climates are never made aware of this fact. And they always live in this blissful illusion that life is all about blue skies and happiness.
It's interesting.
And monsoons.
I recently had this this vision that I was traveling in a large city which was so vast that I could not even see the sky, and so expansive that I could not see a horizon that was natural. And I left my jacket in the men's room, and I returned later there to retrieve my jacket and found that it was still there, and there was in me some spiritual victory that it was not stolen. But I found that the word fixed was written upon it several times in very, very dark black ink, clearly by someone who wanted to destroy the jacket. And it was a denim jacket, so obviously I didn't really care, but I think it symbolizes a spiritual death, a blindness.
That's fascinating, Dr. Jalas. I'm reminded of an experience of my own from just yesterday in which I went out of my house in the morning and went to see my my velo. It was not in its usual Parkplatz, and it's that is to say, I ride. I do not like to ride in automobiles, but rather on the bicycle with two wheels. And when this occurs, I get home and I always put it in the same location. I lock it up. Ultimately, I would love to live in a society in which we have no borders and we have no locks, and these are not necessary. But unfortunately, in Cambridge, if one does not lock up their bicycle, the bicycle is no longer there. And this kind of absence is not simply a metaphorical one, but a material one that has real material implications for transportation and movement of bodies. So when I saw that my bicycle, or this bicycle, I don't want to, you know, ascribe a possession to it, this bicycle was not there, it surprised me. And I felt very strange, especially because I was already wearing my bicycle helmet. And without a bicycle, wearing a bicycle helmet takes on a very different significance in this society.
Which would be?
Well, I think that people see someone with a bicycle helmet, they expect a bicycle.
Precisely. I mean, and I really hope for this situation someday where we can live in a society where a person could simply, as a member of the society, pluck a bicycle from the corner and ride to his destination and leave the bicycle at the destination.
Or from a tree.
Or from the tree. That these things would belong to everyone.
Yes, I think that that is the ideal socialist society. Or it's one aspect of it anyway.
If I may finish
my story, thank you. It is, the conclusion was that the bicycle had actually, I'd parked it a little bit in a different location, and so ultimately I found it. But in that moment when I thought that there was no bicycle, and there was a bicycle helmet, it was a complete dissociation from my spatial relations, and also in terms of time, because I was now not only 5 minutes away from my destination, but I was suddenly 20 minutes away if I had to walk to that destination. So a simple dislocation like that can have magnificent effects.
Well, I wonder, this ideal society, which wouldn't have borders of possession, would it also apply to the human body?
So, oh, indeed. The body without organs is an integral part of this thinking through.
Well, also, I mean, as members of society, would we all share the same body in a certain sense? Would we not have restrictions of marriage? Units.
I think one basic thing would be that we do share a body in the sense that if I see someone on the street who is hungry, then I should feel as responsible for his hunger as I would for my own hunger and be as desperate to satisfy that need.
Even perhaps offering your own body as fuel for his body.
Well, if things should be driven to that point.
We see these metaphors in language of the social body, the political body, the body politic, and I believe that it's important to interrogate the signification of these meanings and that they are not simply metaphors, but that we can consider them to be bodies, that the body is not simply the anatomical body of the discipline of an anatomy, but is... It occurs in many linguistic contexts.
That's true. I often find bodies of text to be even more beautiful than the human body, or at least certain human bodies, which I find particularly unbeautiful.
In the university, we also encounter the student body, which is not, as they say, the body of an individual student, but the totality of students.
See, I made that error once, and it led to a lawsuit when I was a professor.
I'm sorry, I find this very strange about this country, that there are so many lawsuits, but this is perhaps a different matter.
Well, I wonder also if sexual harassment laws are sort of a sign and a symbol of a deeply capitalist society, where we have this strong boundary between our bodies, which can't be violated.
Oh yes, my good friend Slavoj, he has written an article which I think is very apt to your point, which he argues that at any moment in any human interaction that is either seduction or harassment, somebody has to make a pass. If there's an attraction or a desire for something of this romantic or sexual nature, that there's a moment at which someone must make a pass, and that entirely that the action itself does not constitute harassment or seduction. That it depends entirely on the person, the other person, the other body's reaction to it. That if they are welcoming, then, oh yes, it's seduction. It is completely legitimate, acceptable, welcome, and they can go off and do whatever they do. Or if it is unwelcome, if it is seen as inappropriate by the recipient of that so-called pass, then it is considered harassment, and there are real legal material implications to that. Someone can be sued, they can lose their job, they can have complaints filed against them.
So I think we can all agree that in an ideal world and society, that the world would be full of seduction and seduction only.
I don't engage in this kind of imaginative process because I think that we need to criticize the current conditions and how to theorize out through them and of them. For example, if you're interacting with another person, you are always there are conditions of possibility that predicate that interaction, history, language, your experience with each other is entirely dependent on what terms are available to you and what cultural significations are available to you, and those will be different depending entirely on the context, depending on your body of knowledge and their body of knowledge.
And of course, the New Age ideal is that we take all cultural backgrounds and histories and we mix them together into a perfect whole in which we no longer need to be concerned about with these distasteful investigations.
Yes, a kind of Esperanto sexuality, in which we all speak one sexual language, but it contains many parts. Yeah. Is that what you mean, Dr. Levine?
Well, I'm not just referring to the carnal nature of man, but everything about human society, that we take a bit of everything, and by combining it together in one pot and simmering for approximately 2 hours, we could achieve a new mix, a new blend, which embodies the best of our histories and the best of our natures.
And by 2 hours, of course, you refer to 2 divine hours,
of
which
course
represents many generations.
Well, no, it represents about 6 human hours.
Precisely.
I hate to burst your bubble, Dr. Levine, but I will have to say that I don't believe it is that simple. I think that this may be a fantasy from what is often called armchair anthropology, or a New Age, maybe a New Age kind of armchair theorizing, in that there are many people who may be very happy with their cultural heritage and do not want to simply exchange it for a race to the bottom, Walmart variety.
Well, I assure
stew.
You, Frau Doctor, this is not just armchair theorizing. I have meditated upon the subject for many decades and actually inhabited the consciousness of people from all cultures and all walks of life, and I have felt what they would feel and felt their need for a New Age synthesis.
I think in my circles this sort of theorizing is actually called beanbag theorizing. And
of course, the beanbag being invented in Cairo around the turn of the century when you were born.
I can see where you're going with this, and that if you think of everyone as a single bean, a human bean, then it is inside of the bag, and that whoever may be sitting on the bag, whether it's God or, some economic structures, that there's a containment in which we are all, we're bound, and we have a kind of boundedness, and within that, that entails a unity, a totality, a kind of oneness of humanity, even though we are many beings inside a bag.
You know, my main criticism of Marxist thought has always been its utter lack of spiritual depth and feeling. Maybe you could respond to that.
Well, that's quite a harsh and totalizing claim. I'm not quite sure where to begin. I mean, this is basically the essential project of my work, is to try to think through the God problem, the spirituality problem, as part of Marxist theorizing. Marxianism is not meant to be a fixed science. Certainly, I mean, my training, I am very indebted to people such as Lukács, who redefined Orthodox Marxism to mean not Second International Stalinism, but rather a kind of process. That is to say, the method, the thinking, the asking of questions, of critical reasoning, that is what is at essence, and with it a sense of, you know, materialism being at the heart of that. That if we can think of spirituality as also a material issue, that if we think of God as something excreted from the brain or something that is part of human experiences, which are material experiences, that spirituality cannot be apart from that, that is not simply superstructural, or even if it is superstructural, that's an important part of the superstructure and therefore must be engaged by Marxist cultural criticism.
Well, Frau Doctor, have you tried such stimulants such as LSD or MSG?
Yes, I have tried both of these.
So I feel like if you engage with these types of spiritual stimulants, you might actually be able to move past the Marxian veil of ignorance and see the inner truth.
And when you say veil of ignorance, I would generally associate that term with John Rawls, who is certainly not a Marxist, but rather a moral philosopher in the Anglo-American tradition. Or and perhaps you could elaborate.
Well, I mean by that this, that all Marxianist thought is predicated upon free flow of words. And words, of course, are really just illusions, and reality is something that's subverbal. And I think we have to really, really strive for the subverbal. And I think instead of writing books using these words, we should really be taking MSG.
Well, I would certainly agree with you that words are not should not be sort of operating in their own plane apart from the material. Indeed, the material is at the heart of Marxist criticism. So I believe that we have much in common, Dr. Levine, and that there's much ground for engagement here.
So I like to think of a word as a cloud or a feather that ascends into the heaven and which I can latch onto with my hand or recline upon wearing a white robe as it takes me up into the heavenly sphere.
I do wonder if there is some river where all this confusion and irritatedness and maybe angst would be a good word could be washed away, and we could leave it in the river for the river to become confused and then pour that into the ocean, and so that we could float away and leave a confused planet behind.
And not worry about the beachgoers, I presume.
Well, we would cleanse them
afterwards.
As a body, we would, you know, again, this issue with the body, right? That we arrive at the river of sense or reason, or I'm not sure what we would call this water, and we would dip our brains into it and leave behind all of the confusion, all of the problems.
Now, some of course advocate meditation as a form of brain cleansing. Now, I personally feel that liver cleansing is also quite essential for the goal of spiritual enlightenment. The liver can actually be a heavy weight upon one's spiritual ascent.
Well, many ancient cultures regarded the liver as the seat of love. So it's not surprising that we would regard it even now as heavy, even though we know that other organs contain love.
That's right, and although the heart is often considered the seat of passionate love, the liver would be the seat of divine love.
Or perhaps even motherly love, since in an embryo, the liver is extremely pronounced. I remember holding a small pig embryo in my hand as a child in the science course and cutting into it and seeing that it was almost entirely liver.
Perhaps the embryo had a drinking disorder.
That sounds delicious, I might say.
Yes. I mean, the uterus itself of the pig is quite a delicacy in my village where my grandmother is from.
Well, perhaps it would be good to reach out to our listeners. If anyone would like to call in, you know, as you know, the show is not about us sitting and pontificating and
about fetal pig uteri
and disseminating
livers.
Our beliefs about these things. It's really about connecting. And if you'd like to connect with us in a more responsive way, the number is 617-253-8810, and we have two open lines. In the meantime, I do wonder why it was these organs that were regarded as the seats of various emotions.
Mm.
Instead of, for instance, the eyes or the eyebrows or something.
Well, of course, Aristotle himself theorized that the heart was the seat of human intelligence. And he thought that the brain was essentially an air conditioner for the body, which would explain why when one has their head decapitated, one dies through overheating. Just like a car, when its air conditioner breaks, the
passengers
drivers
all
die
due to overheating, particularly in the weather of late. It's interesting, the ancient Egyptians also believed that the brain was worthless. They would preserve the other organs, they would leave the heart in the body for the, you know, to remain there for the next life, and they would throw the brain away.
Well, as a feminist, I must interject that, of course, the ancient Greeks, such as Aristotle, also believed that in terms of heat, that men operated as a higher heat than women, and actually that was why men were required to that their semen was required for conception, that otherwise that women have, you know, the necessary parts for creating a new life, except that they do not have the necessary heat. Mm. It is as if you have some uncooked meat and you need to simply cook it. And what the man would do would be to interject into the woman some heat.
Let's bring another voice into this discussion to add some heat. Caller, welcome to the air.
Hi, this is Dave from Cambridge.
Welcome, Dave.
Hi, I was calling about some of my New Age visions.
Oh, please share them with us.
I saw this thing where there was a motor coach that turned into a an amphibious vehicle that could go into the water, and I started thinking more about different modes.
That's the, I think, referring to the duck tour.
Well, Dave, is that a boat that becomes a submarine? Dave, I think we've lost Dave.
Probably has become consumed by a new mystical vision.
It could be.
I do think this issue of transmogrification of technology is fascinating, though. We have this popular series now, The Transformers, and I find this so fascinating to me, because you have the Transformers, and I believe they're fighting a group that is called the Decepticons. And the Transformers, obviously, they transform from one thing into another. And most of the time, when they are in their original form, they are doing something that is akin to deception. It's passing. It's a saying they are something when they are actually also something else. And whether that's real or not, I think this is fascinating. The Decepticons,
what are they really? Are they really...
Well, indeed, that's the question. They're very much troubling this essentialist notion that one must be a one thing or the other, that one can actually be both, and that there can be an ongoing transformation or transformation, then transform back, transform again, and it's very much very subversive, I believe. But I'm fascinated by this idea that then the other side, that they are called the Decepticons, and that there's this negative connotation to the deception.
So they actually never take part in any deception?
Well, the main problem, in my opinion, the reason why the Decepticons are evil is not because they are deceiving, but because they are trying to kill all of humankind. That's the genocide that is really the crux of their issue as the nemesis, as the villain character in this narrative.
Yes, that's true. In most cultures that I studied, genocide is usually considered a worse sin than deception.
Indeed, but their name, this epithet levied against them, that so you know that they're the bad guys in the narrative. It's not that they're the killers or the genociders. It's that they are the Decepticons, which indeed is simply a different inflection, a less euphemized version of Transformers.
Hmm. And again, in many ancient and still popular mythological systems, the great, you know, there's a tendency to have a bipolar or a polar deities, a good deity who is strong but remote, or who, for whatever reason, chooses to permit a more evil deity to operate. And then there is that evil deity. The name of the evil deity is sometimes the deceiver or the rejecter or various other words which really do seem mild when compared to modern crimes like public urination or you know, outright driving into windows or
copyright violations.
Copyright violations or stealing MP3s.
Yes, I've always been fascinated by religious traditions which have not only a source of good in the world, but which also posit a source of evil. And it always reminds me of Star Wars, it reminds me of the dark side, which is a real force, and it's really powerful and really seductive. And I've often myself felt the lure of this dark force in my life. And I've never quite crossed over all the way, but I've often felt that if I were Luke Skywalker, I would have become a member of the dark side myself.
I mean, and then, you know, alongside all of these visions, and you know, I call them visions because we don't know if reality is anything more. We have these images of very solid-looking animals that are dancing like Ganesh, who has his rings and he throws things, and it's very confusing to know what's real and what is not even fake real.
Hmm. I find that such kind of performances, though, may be initially perceived as fake. Indeed, that's actually how something becomes real. Indeed, a performative statement. A performative, as called by the famous linguist J.L. Austin, that this is a word that, or a sentence that operates to create something in and of itself, such as a phrase such as, I pronounce you married. That phrase makes someone married. Nothing outside of that does. It is that sentence. Or to name a ship or a baby is to do something with words, to have a kind of speech act. Where the action is made up of speech.
Hmm. Well, this reminds me of this famous actor. His name is escaping me. He played Dr. Strangelove in Dr. Strangelove and the Pink Panther. Do you remember his name? Famous comedic actor. He was in Lolita. Played one of the characters. Anyway, so this famous comedic actor... apparently, he had so many different personas that he would inhabit in his life that he would actually, it would take him about 20 minutes to half an hour upon awakening in the morning to sort of shift and find the persona that he was to inhabit for that day. And so he'd be sort of confused for about half an hour every morning. So I think this is a great example of someone who starts with something imaginary, play acting, and then they become, the play acting becomes the truth in which they live.
Let's bring another voice in with us here. Marhaban caller.
I wanted to say about the comment about how, like, words or particular, well, how you're talking about like words being meaningless pretty much, or like rather words mostly are meaningless in a sense. But, like, if you were to, like, share something like marriage, I would think that words would be beyond that. All and, like, most, however, that would be, like, a social, like, document. So, like, social, like, documents, or, like, documents, like, as far as, like, wait, that's not really, like, how I would view laws. I just confused myself trying to talk or kind of like
No, thank you. That's very important. I'm glad that you're, you know, we have listeners out there who are thinking about these issues. I always enjoy how people will repeat and rephrase the kinds of words that we have said on our show and how then we can dialogue back with you through this phone conversation. So I appreciate your contribution. So what I was discussing before was this idea, it's a philosopher from the 1950s, and this idea has been expanded upon extensively since then, but the essence of the idea, the crux of it, is that certain sentences in English have a different kind of operation that they are performed, that the sentence, I promise, is not the same as the sentence, I bicycle.
I apologize.
Well, I apologize also functions in the same way as a performative. Or I witness, that these are statements that constitute something and have real legal consequences. If I say I witness something and it turns out that, you know, that that's not accurate, then I can have real legal, there can be real legal consequences to that.
Of course, I think Wittgenstein would argue that all speech is performative.
Of course, there are other examples that are really on the, they are ambiguous. So I often hear people say to me that they beg me. You know, I beg you. And I think to myself, I know what begging is. Begging is a man on his knees kissing my feet. And saying that he begs me is not really a beg.
So a deaf mute would be able to beg you?
Certainly, he could indeed.
Well, indeed, I think that you've touched upon an important point, Dr. Jealous, that there are somatic aspects or body language, getting back to this central category today of the body, that can constitute a performative, and it is not simply words. Austin was a linguist, so he was most interested in English language sentences, but that does not constitute the totality of what a performance is. There can be bodily engagements that too constitute an act of identification and of producing oneself.
I should also mention that the actor who I was referring to earlier is, of course, the famous Peter Sellers.
Oh, yes, of course. An excellent actor.
Yeah, I knew him well. Yeah, it's interesting, though, that that simply speaking can be an action.
I think that...
everything it seems like meaningless, I was gonna say.
I think actually I would say quite the opposite, that indeed there are a multiplicity of meanings overlaid onto one another, and that there's not simply a unitary meaning or an inherent meaning in any word. A word is not something that always was, but rather it's constructed. Somebody decided, or socially we have decided, that certain words are attached to certain meanings, and that those meanings are dependent entirely upon context, social, cultural context, historical context, even very local contexts. You know, you and your sibling may have assigned a certain meaning to a word in secret as your own little language, and that others would not be aware of that. So there could be these inside references that also function on a local level.
I find the best way to shake this illusion, this living in this social world, is to repeat every word that you say at least 15 times. And by the 15th time, or for some people the 16th time, the sort of psychological semantic contagion of the word starts to wear away, and they can actually see the word for what it is, which is just a puff of air.
So that was like everything. I was going to say that everything's more, is more what's the word for it? Like everything's affecting each other, like. Like tangible,
or it's all interconnected.
That word.
It's all relational.
That's
maybe.
Holistic.
Like, like sound affects everything and like movement affects everything. And it's just like the language is just kind of like thick. I would say that society right now is kind of running on with the way that technology is and cars and everything and like the movement, it's kind of like bad for where you have to develop techniques to deal with your blood pressure and stuff. I would say it would be like, I don't know.
And interestingly, all these often, you know, I have this image of a very fat man who's red in the face counting backwards from 10, you know, 10, 9. He's really trying to bring about calm using the numbers and the names of the numbers.
Is this fat man perhaps working at NASA?
Perhaps not.
Because I think if he is, he's not actually trying to achieve calm, but actually counting down for a space shuttle liftoff.
No, I have this image of a man who is so angry for whatever reason, like transdermal mediator cut him off in the traffic or, you know, and he's standing there trying to recenter himself using words.
Yeah.
But it's really thoughts and ideas that can bring you in or out of the centricity. And sooner or later, the numbers will cease to have their original meaning to him. Because 10 may be his name for a large hammer that he would like to hit that transdermal mediator with, for example. And suddenly all these numbers, which are so neutral or even friendly, become these angry words. And I may retort and refer to the man as a ham sandwich, even though that is a, you know, an neither negative nor positive. He can take it how he will.
Well, negative for you, presumably.
Especially while I am fasting. Let's bring a second caller in with us. Caller 2, welcome.
Hi, I was wondering if we could talk about what Lichtenstein called the domain of the unreal.
Certainly, caller.
Do you have a specific question?
No, I've just heard about that concept, and if something's unreal, how could it have a domain?
Well, I find many unreal things have domains.
Such as what?
Well, we're all actually unreal, and we all have our own domain, since life itself is a form of unreality, in my opinion, at least.
And can't I have a place for unreal things? Like, would that not be a domain of the unreal?
Like a thought or a memory? Like a place in your heart for a memory?
Or even like I have in my house a box for things that don't exist.
Really?
And yeah, I place them there in my mind, mentally.
The box does exist, though.
As far as anything else exists in my house.
Well, that's very interesting. Thank you very much.
I've often wondered whether we are in fact inhabitants of someone else's dream, or perhaps inhabitants of a fictional account of some story someone's writing. I think one of the two must be true, and I haven't really determined which one it is.
So we are all lies in a book of falsehoods?
Unless it's, we may actually be characters in a nonfiction book, in which case we are truths.
We are truths in a history book.
But we're unreal truths. So we are fictional representations of some other reality.
I think it's better than being items on a menu.
So with words, you have to say that reality is the conscious words, I mean the conscious world that everybody subscribes to, and you have to say what is unreal is, like, say Dr. Jollis's box is unreal, even though it may have, in his meditative states, very, what I would want to say, is, or for my myself, if I were to describe something as my meditative world, I would want to say had a very realness to me. But if I were to say that this realness is real to someone in the everyday world, they would become confused and I would be confused.
Now,
as I am now.
I've lived in some places where people are, they will often say things like real fact to emphasize that it's not a lie. Have you heard these phrases before?
I have not.
Yeah, people will refer to things as real facts. I think it's common in the Washington, D.C. area, which I've always found fascinating, but I think this is exactly what Robert here is talking about.
It gets confusing talking to people. I would say that it's hard for me to subscribe to this society. I see no real way to prevent the flow that has already occurred. So I'm mostly just live my life upon fantasy and conditions which are mostly legal.
Well, I think confusion itself is not entirely negative. In fact, confusion is often the penultimate step in the steps towards enlightenment. So often there'll be an initial ascent of clarity and spiritual well-being, and then before one reaches the final stage, one will pass through very thick storm clouds of confusion and bewilderment.
Well, I've wondered many times in my hours of meditation whether or not... Now, you know, I'm a free thinker and a spiritual being, but I certainly do not bind myself to follow a single book or mythology. And yet I have found again and again that it is important to have a common mythology to discuss things with people, a reference point, because as Robert says, it's difficult to connect with someone from first principles, but I find that, you know, if we have shared stories or myths or something, characters that we can refer to, that it really helps quite a bit. And I think that in our soulless society, that television sitcoms take the place of these ancient tales.
So Justin Timberlake would be the equivalent of maybe Shiva.
Precisely. And so my advice to Robert is to do what you must to connect with the people around you, if that is what you want to do.
I am, well, I'm not so much impartial. Mostly is, in my mind, is conditions that have been instilled in me as a very small child, eating habits for a lot of parts, even though I have grown out of many eating habits, but I have yet to shake my childlike fantasy of being married. And as far as this society goes, I have yet to meet any people that, or not meet people, I have a hard time meeting people in a sense that you can't let, or like, what it is you were talking about earlier, like boundaries and speaking things and like how people do things, like it's all... Someone just called me pathetic.
I understand what you are going for completely, and these preconceptions are so dangerous also, because we look around and we see so many people that are living in happiness outside of these boundaries, and people who are so attentive to them cannot tolerate that sort of life, and so we're as a consequence of having these dreams, we have an intolerant society.
Yeah, like what if you just wanted to like pretend you were married, even like in your own head, because you knew it was like just a, because everything seems like mostly just stimulus, or like if you like everybody's just working, like can you just live inside your own and your own head legally?
I think that you, if you try to do such a thing, then you will be regularly facing someone bashing you over the head with a reality stick. And
I believe those marriages are not considered valid in the state of Massachusetts, at least not yet.
There are three major institutions that you'll have to encounter: the law, phallic sexuality, or in this case, marriage, and just the social order writ large.
Well, we have another caller. Let's see if we can briefly have that caller before the end of the hour. Caller 5, welcome. Caller 5?
Hello.
Hello, marhaban.
I already solved my problem. I'm going to get a Facebook and offer my body to any woman of my own age. Because it's disgusting how this society is, and I'm going to go on a silence pact where I only say certain words. You know, maybe I will write them down and help you guys figure them out for me in the most legal sense, is what is most appropriate to the American government.
Robert, I have to admit it doesn't sound like a healthy solution to me. It sounds like an act of desperation.
I had a hamburger the other day at Dr. Jollis, and I thought it tasted good.
I think I see where that's going, but unfortunately we'll have to carry this this discussion on next time.
Yeah, I do not like this country and the way that thought is flowing.
Yeah, well, good luck to you, Robert. So we'll be back in 2 weeks. Next week I will be traveling, so unless I can get my co-host to carry the banner forward, we will be back in 2 weeks, which I think is the 25th of September. So thanks again to my callers and to my co-hosts here, Frau Dr. Zina van Kuchen.
Solidarity.
And to Professor Levine.
Namaste.
I'm Editor Jalis Sakran here on Music for Humans. Music for Humans is New Age Talk Radio with an emphasis on you, here on 88.1 FM WMBR in Cambridge. Stay tuned for Hidden Gems in Plain Sight. Ma'a salama.
Safety.
Number one,
cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two,
look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first and bicycle.